The first topic I'll be discussing is rent control. The first time rent control occurred, as far as my research showed, is World War I, but this was just a few months and it didn't really amount to too much, so most people who analyze rent control sort of ignore that. The next time, the so-called first generation of rent control came about with regard to World War II. I think it was in December of 41 when we were in the war. And what happened was they would have a great need to have all sorts of people on the coast because they were building ships and getting soldiers or sailors into the water and what have you. So you get a typical supply and demand situation where here was the supply of housing and here was the ordinary demand of housing, and all of a sudden there was this gigantic shift to the right of demand because soldiers and sailors and wives and these and those people all had to be in Newport News, Virginia, or places on the coast, on the West Coast and the East Coast. And you'll never guess what happened to rents. Yes? Rents rose, which showed greed and evil of landlords. It had nothing to do with supply and demand, as you all know. And in order to stop these unconscionable landlords from taking advantage of the greedy situation, what have you, they imposed rent control. Now, the way rent control occurred, it was never really... See, this is the classical situation, or the classical way that most rent control is illustrated, and you have a price below equilibrium for rent control, at which point demand is greater than supply. I'm drawing the supply curve this way, although in the short run it's vertical. You can't build much housing in the short run. Actually, rent control didn't come about this way. What happened, rather, was that rents were frozen at a certain point. There was never a law that said rents have to be below what they are now. Rather, the law was rents have to be what they are now. So you think, well, that's not much of a control, because if it's at equilibrium, which it never is, but there's a tendency in that direction, well, you know, big deal, there's no rent control. But what happens is when you have inflation, the supply curve rises, the demand curve rises, and you get rid of these old supply and demand curves, you get rid of the straight line, not the dotted line ones, and you're left with the dotted line ones, which is like that. Do you get what I'm saying? In other words, the solid lines vanish because of inflation, and now, even though it was not a price control below equilibrium, it was rather a fixity of rents. You just can't raise your rents. Well, it looks like this. So we get back to this sort of a diagram, which is reasonable. Okay, in the first generation of rent controls, there were no exceptions. This was a radical rent control. You know, that was it. Prices were frozen, and that's it. Well, after the war, this stayed on, and they noticed something curious, probably just accidental, coincidental, but no one was building residential rental units. Isn't that amazing? I mean, if Aunt Tilly left you $1 million and rents were regulated, but nothing else is regulated after the decontrol after the war. Shirts were now unregulated, the wristwatches, whatever, eyeglasses. Naturally, the money would gravitate toward these other things because you can make a buck there, whereas in the case of rent control, you couldn't. So, did the geniuses get rid of rent control? Well, some of them did, actually. My dissertation, my PhD dissertation, was an analysis of rent control, where here was a whole bunch of variables like lousy housing or good housing or what have you. Here was presence or absence of rent control. And here were other things trying to keep ceteris paribus conditions, other things equal, like the wealth of a city or what have you. And my dissertation showed, when I got it right, when I got the coefficients right, that indeed the more rent control a city had, the more recently it was decontrolled, or in New York City's case it was never gotten rid of, the worse things were in the dependent variable, the Y. So some of them did get rid of rent control, but New York City didn't. Because, you know, that's the socialist people's paradise of New York City, so we have to have rent control. And What they did instead was they had so-called second-generation rent control. And what second-generation rent control was they had exceptions. If you built a new building, previously, the rent control commissioner, anyone stupid enough to build a new building, the rent control commissioner would come by and say, well, here's how much you can charge. And they wouldn't allow you to, you know, charge much. So they made an exception for new building. You build a new building, you can charge whatever you want. The market, the, you know. And also, if there was any decontrol of an extant apartment in a building if somebody moved. Now, previously, you can understand what kind of incentives there were for various kinds of landlords without rent control. The incentive that a landlord have is to serve the customers, like every other place, a restaurant, a school, a private school, to serve the customers, because if they don't, then, you know, they lose money. But when you have vacancy decontrol, all of a sudden you put an impetus on a different kind of a landlord, namely someone who can encourage people to leave. Now all of a sudden, it became Adam Smith's invisible hand was leading us in a different direction for landlords, namely someone who could hire thugs to, you know, hassle tenants and get them to leave. You'd make more money than if you were a nice guy and you fixed the plumbing. And also, if you fix the plumbing, you're an idiot if you're a landlord. Because the last thing you want to do is satisfy these people who are paying very, very low rents compared to what the market price would be. So that was the second generation of rent control. The third generation came in the... I'm a little hazy on the dates. I think in the 80s or the 70s, this is mainly New York City. What happened was previously, if you had a land area, this was your land area, you could build on 70% of the land. But the planning commissioners and those guys decided that 70% was not enough, or rather 70% was too much. You could only now build on 40%, because we needed more green space, right? But they gave everyone a year or so, I forget how much time they gave you, to get in a foundation under the old 70% rule. So guess what happened? Everyone and his uncle was getting in new housing. You know, you rip down stuff, you knock down stuff, you put in a foundation anywhere. And now it takes... because you want to get in under the old 70% rules. So it takes how long to build a high-rise? 2, 3, 4 years? Okay. So then when all these new houses come on stream, guess what happens to the price? Again, you know, the supply now is shifted way over to the right because of this zoning variance. And rents are going very, very low. Landlords are promising people, oh, 6 months free rent. You know, please come rent one of these apartments. Because, you know, we're up to our armpits in empty apartments. You know, come rent. We'll charge you very little. We'll give you a free year's rent if you sign a 3-year lease or whatever, or a 6-year lease. Okay, the next story, and meanwhile, does anyone build under the new 40% rule? No. Nobody's building. So now these 5-year leases come due 5 years later, and guess what the greedy landlords do? They jack up the rents unconscionably. So what we have to do now is not have rent control, we have to have this new thing called rent stabilization. Because you can't have rent control, because the law was that if you built under the old rent control law and it was a new building, they couldn't control it. So they didn't control it. They stabilized it. Don't ask me the difference. You know, it's just a different name, but it's a way of getting around the so-called contract that they had with the builders. Okay. The case of the South Bronx is very interesting. What happened was, you can see that the market failed here. The rental market failed because, you know, all of this stuff, and, you know, nobody was building and nobody was repairing stuff. So what they had to have was public housing. Because, you know, the market failed, the government has to step in to make good of market failure. So they had public housing. Now, one way to get on public housing was to get on a waiting list. But if your house burned down, you'd get to the head of the waiting list. And also, A lot of these apartment buildings were insured under the old pre-rent stabilized, rent-controlled prices. Right? So the building was insured for $1 million, but with rent control, the thing's worth $100,000, really? But if it burns, baby burns, you could sell it for $100,000, but you get $1 million. Well, guess what happened? I hate to keep you people in suspense, but the South Bronx burned. and Bedford-Stuyvesant and Harlem and other poor areas. In the rich areas, it didn't burn because even though you had a lot of rent control, every time you got a decontrol, you'd raise an apartment from, you know, 100 a month to 2,000 a month, and those apartments that were not rent controlled carried the building, so to speak. In addition to this burn, baby, burn stuff, there was this other quaint practice of tenants. If you didn't pay your rent. Now look, if you go into a department store like Don always does, he got this t-shirt by stealing it from Lou, and he told you I'd pick on you. He doesn't pay for it. We know what happens to him. He goes to jail where he richly deserves. But the Don princes of the world, what they do is they go to rent an apartment, and around October, November, they just stop paying rent. And the landlord takes them to court, and now it takes a month or two to get them to court because the courts, you know, got long waiting lists. They're not very efficient. These are public courts, not free enterprise courts. And now it's November or December, and the judge says, you know, Don, you should pay your rent, otherwise we're going to kick you out. However, Christmas is coming. You can't kick people out during Christmas, can you? No, that would be cruel and unusual, whatever. So for 6 months a year, people would move in September or, you know, start not paying their rent in September. And by January, maybe you can get them out, or February, you can get them out. So this was not only rent control in the sense that the prices were limited, but you couldn't collect any rent. So, of course, you want to burn the place down. Now, there's this guy, Assar Lindbeck, a Swedish socialist economist, which is a redundancy. my apologies if there are any Swedes here. I'm sure there are some exceptions. But what he said is, next to bombing, rent control is the most dangerous thing for housing, or the best way to ruin housing next to bombing is rent control. Mm-hmm. So I did this book. I edited this book when I was at the Fraser Institute on rent control. And what I did is I got a whole bunch of pictures of New York City, South Bronx especially, and Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Dresden. Now, I have a little confession to make. I took the worst cases of rent control and the least damaged ones of the bombing, because, you know, bombing is worse than rent control. I mean, you know, some of those bombing places was just nothing. You know, I wanted housing, and I had to eliminate all pictures where there were black people, because that would be a dead giveaway, and I wanted to test the reader if you could tell the difference. And all pictures where there are Oriental people or this Oriental architecture, you know, where you could tell. So the Dresden stuff came in handy. And what I did is I got, maybe 200-300 pictures, and I picked the least damaged bombing and the most damaged rent control, and I illustrated each chapter with one of them, and at the back I had, you know, which was which. I couldn't tell the difference, you know, a couple of weeks after I had picked. So that's a, sort of an illustration of what the rent control situation is like. Okay, enough on rent control. The next thing I want to do is minimum wage. Now, the minimum wage situation is one replete with charity, welfare, all sorts of considerations for the poor, and how do we solve problems of poverty. If you ask most people, why is it that the poor people in this country make a living? What is the minimum wage law now? $5.50 or something? $6? $5.15? Why do the people make $5.15? It's because, thank God for the minimum wage. Because without the minimum wage, wages would be dictated by the employer. And we know employers are only second to landlords in greed. You know, the real cause of inflation is greed. And what we ought to do is create a greed index, and it would, you know, sort of map inflation. You know, when greed goes up, prices go up. And so we know what wage the employer would pay. You know, a penny an hour, 2 cents an hour, whatever. because landlords are inherently evil and, you know, they want to push wages down and ruin workers, and we'd have the reserve army of the unemployed and the Marxists and the lefties. So the minimum wage is a very popular thing on college campuses where citadels of unreason and irrationality of all majors other than econ majors. What I want to do is introduce a few concepts. One of them is this thing called marginal revenue product. Marginal revenue product equals marginal physical product times price. And what you have is a situation like here is labor, and we assume a certain amount of capital. And let's suppose we have 10,000 workers, and we add on one more worker. And let's suppose that by adding on this one more worker, we get 20 more units of the product, whatever the product is, shoes, it doesn't matter, wristwatches. And let's suppose that the price of the product is 10 cents. Therefore, the marginal revenue product, or marginal revenue productivity, or productivity, is $2 per hour. Okay, so for every hour we have this guy on our staff, we get 20 extra widgets or units of whatever the product is. They're worth 10 cents each. They're worth $2 an hour. That's his contribution to the product. Now, is this given? Well, it's sort of an experiment, because you're really comparing a situation with him and without him, and you never get the ideal situation. These other things can always change. Maybe the 20,000 workers were goofing off, or maybe they were enthusiastic. So it's always an estimate. But the point is that the employer who estimates this the best makes the most profit, as I'll try to demonstrate later. Okay, so here we have marginal revenue product. And we economists have this theory that wages tend to equal marginal revenue product. Okay? So if the marginal, if $2 an hour equals the marginal revenue product, we say that that has to equal the wage. And there are really only three hypotheses. Either the wage will be higher than the marginal revenue product, equal to it, or less than. And what I'm going to do is try to show why these two are wrong, and equal is the equilibrium tendency, or the direction in which the market is operating. Okay, well, let's take the case where the wage is higher than the marginal revenue product. Suppose that the wage is $5 an hour. Okay? And the marginal revenue product, this one worker, is $2 an hour. Well, what's going to happen to the employer that pays $5 an hour and gets $2 an hour worth from an employee? He's going to lose $3 an hour. He does that once too often with too many employees, he's broke. He goes bankrupt. He makes losses and then he goes bankrupt. So we can sort of cross this off as a long-term enduring kind of a situation. It can't endure. Okay. Let's take the case here where the employer is paying 1 cent an hour. Not $1 an hour, but 1 cent an hour. A penny. Okay? If he's paying a penny an hour, as a good capitalist pig should be, right? The profit and loss balance sheet looks like something like this, that the gain is $2. That's the marginal revenue product. That's what the worker is giving him. The cost is a penny. Therefore, the profit is $1.99, which is reasonably good. Okay, now, you're what's your name? Annie, you just won this award. You're a capitalist pig, too. And Alan now has hired him for $1.99. And you're sort of cheering Alan on because you love the idea of, you know, exploiting workers, you know. But you'd rather exploit them than him. So what are you going to do? What offer are you going to make to this worker? Pay him more. How much do you think you'd offer him? $2 an hour?
Silly.
No, what kind of capitalist? What kind of capitalist pig are you? Get out! We're taking back this award that you got, because, see, they didn't mention yesterday that this award was for capitalist pigs. The correct answer is 2 cents. Because, you know, the workers get uppity and disrespectful if you give them too much money, right? Now, you're also a capitalist pig, Ed. What are you going to offer this poor, beleaguered worker?
3 cents.
3 cents, right. And then it goes on. Not that this would be a realistic thing, but I'm saying that this is the market process, that if it went this way, it would get up to $2 an hour. It might not get exactly there. It would depend upon if there are lots of workers out there. And it doesn't have to come just from the side of the employer. It can also come from the side of the employee. One employee says to the employer, other employee at the bowling league or whatever, you know, I'm making 25 cents an hour. How much are you? And the guy says, oh, I'm making $1.95. And he says, you know, I beat you at bowling. Maybe I'll quit my job and try to get a better job. So this impetus, this equation of the marginal revenue product and the wage can come from two sources. One, from employers bidding from workers, and the other, workers asking for raises or quitting if they don't get what they want. The reason that the growers go down from California down to Mexico is because they think that the Mexican workers, whose wages are 10 cents an hour, are worth $2 an hour. So they'll pay them a buck an hour, which is 10 times as much as Mexican workers are getting, so they're delighted to get it. And then you get one of the most evil, vicious people in all of economics, Cesar Chavez, who says, well, the Mexican workers, you don't give them hot and cold water, and you don't do this, and you don't give them good mattresses, so therefore we can't have them come into the country. You get that? I mean, these guys give their eye teeth to do it, but they won't allow it. Okay, let me go back a little bit into economic theory and ask, why do we have jobs in the first place? I mean, why have them? Why just cut out the middleman and not have jobs? Wouldn't that be great if we didn't have jobs? And the answer is, the reason we have to have jobs, the reason we have to work, is because we live in a scarcity society. If stuff rained down on us like manna, a bicycle, a meal, a wristwatch, we wouldn't have to work. If we ever achieve post-scarcity, we wouldn't have to work. The reason we have to work is because we have scarcity. Now, we'll never get out of scarcity. Even no matter how much we invent, no matter how many Bill Gateses there are or other wonderful inventors of stuff, we'll always have scarcity because there are certain things that will always be scarce, no matter how many bananas or BMWs or basketballs we have. One is because there will always be opportunity cost of time. You can't be in two places at one time. Another is that there are certain things that we want that the thing that we want, they don't want us. Now, the usual example I use is Britney Spears, but I'm now going to use Brittany Schaefer, who is our pinup girl. We all want Brittany Schaefer, but she might not want all of us. So there's a scarcity of Brittany Schaefers. You get the point? Even if we had this stuff raining down on us, assuming they weren't raining down Brittany Schaefers on us, we would still have that problem. So always going to have scarcity. We'll always have to have jobs. What creates the jobs is the scarcity. Now, some people say, well, when you have automation, that unemploys you, or if you offshore jobs or anything like that, we have less work to do. There's always more work to do. And the way I try to illustrate this is I make a wish list. Here is my wish list. I go to various people and say, well, what would you like? And they say, oh, I'll have a BMW. And someone else says, I'll have a lobster dinner. And someone else says, I'll have a yacht. And we get all 6 billion people, and we ask them, what would you like? And each of us got a long list of things we'd like. We make a long, 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 long list. What determines how far down we get on this list? What determines how far down on this list we get is how hard we work and how smart we work. And how well coordinated we are, which means economic freedom, which is a way of coordinating our activities so we don't have to have central planning. Now, I come up with a cure for tooth decay. All of a sudden, every dentist job is gone. Right? Isn't this horrible? If you're a Keynesian, you say, oh my God, what did Block do? He's a maniac. He got rid of tooth decay. Because now the dentists will stop buying bicycles, and the bicycle owners will stop buying wristwatches, and you'll have waves of unemployment, and pretty soon the economy will be in the toilet bowl. All because I invented the cure for tooth decay, rotten kid that I am. But the truth of the matter is, if you look at it this way, is you say, well, we can just get a little further down on our wish list because now we've freed up labor. Dentists are pretty bright guys. You know, they can do something else. I don't know what, become carpenters or whittlers or, I don't know.
Economists.
No. There are too many economists. We got to keep people out. What we got to have is a rule that only you can only become an economist if I give you my permission. Sort of like the AMA, but I'll be talking about that in another lecture. But in other words, the point is that these guys are now freed up to do other things. That's why we're very rich. That's why when the car came in and all those horse and buggy jobs disappeared, that was good. It wasn't bad. Because all the horse and buggy people were now free to produce other things that we wanted more than horse and buggies. We only want a few now, just for old time's sake or whatever. Okay, so we've established now that the wage can't be above because there'll be losses. It can't be below because of this market process. Therefore, the wage tends to equalize. Will it equalize perfectly? No. There's always profit and loss in an economy. But you can't have a big divergence between wage and productivity because a big divergence, it's sort of like they say nature abhors a vacuum. Well, economics abhors a gigantic differential between wage and marginal revenue product. And if there is a gigantic differential, something's going to happen. Some capitalist pig is going to offer them more. Or some worker is going to quit and say, hey, I can get double over working for Mr. Jones. So wages tend to equal marginal revenue productivity. Okay, now, there are two theories of the minimum wage law. One theory of the minimum wage law is that it's sort of like a floor. And you raise the floor and you raise everyone on the floor above. And that's the view that most people who are unsophisticated in the minimum wage have, that it's niggardly, it's cheapskatey to have a minimum wage of only a dollar an hour or 40 cents an hour. Raise it. Be decent. Be nice. This is sort of like the West Wing view of the minimum wage law. If you don't raise it, it's because you're rotten. That's one view. That's the incorrect view. The correct view of the minimum wage law, we're now having the Olympics. And in the Olympics, I don't know what the high jump record is, 8 feet or something like that? These guys can actually jump over a high bar of 8 feet. Roughly the 7'8" or something, 7'10" is the world's record. The minimum wage law is a barrier, a bar over which you have to jump in order to get a job. And the higher they raise it, the harder it is to get a job. Okay? I have some empirical illustrations of this, not tests, empirical illustrations. What I did is when I worked in Canada, I compared a whole bunch of provinces, the unemployment rate for the entire population in the various provinces, the minimum wage level, and also the unemployment rate for 20 to 24-year-olds compared to 25 and older. The reason I do that is because it's the young people that have the hardest time jumping over the bar. Older people, we might not be as physically able, but job productivity nowadays doesn't depend upon upper body strength. It depends upon coming to work on time and not fighting with your fellow employees and sassing the customers and things like that. And a certain maturity helps increase your productivity. So the reason I'm taking the one as a fraction of the other is because I want to rule out causes of unemployment that would permeate the whole group. So I just compare the young people with the old people, and you can see it's not a perfect correlation. Whenever you get into empirical research, it doesn't conform perfectly because there are other things going on here beside the minimum wage. But with one variable, I can explain or account for differentials in unemployment. Let me show you this in a slightly different way. What I do here is show the unemployment rates of teenage males compared to adult males for the years 1948 to 64. This comes from Milton Friedman and George Stigler's book on minimum wage law. Milton Friedman was very sound on this question. And what it shows is that the teenage males are unable to jump over the barrier. Now, you see, if you look at this as a physical barrier, I'm 63. I can sort of get up this step, and that's about it, you know. Whereas you young pups, you know, you can jump 5 feet even if you're not trained athletes in the high jump. So the older you are physically, you're less able. But in terms of productivity in the market, people 40, 50, and 60 are more productive than teenagers because they have more experience, more education, more whatever. Okay? So you can see, by the way, before the minimum wage started, I don't show that, there was no differential in the unemployment rate between older and younger workers. Minimum wage law comes. Some people can jump over it. Other people can't. That explains what's going on. So the minimum wage is a disaster. It's a horrible thing. It attacks the least able. You know, in biology, there are certain animals that are very weak. Did I start at 11? Oh, good. I thought I was out of time and I have so much more to do. There are certain animals that are very weak, but they have compensating differentials. Like the porcupine, without the quills, would be helpless. It's got the quills, it can survive. The deer, very helpless animal, but it's fleet of foot, right? Well, in economics, you have the same sort of thing. You get a young black male teenager, for various reasons, their productivity is the lowest of all age, sex, race cohorts. They are very weak economic actors, but they have a compensating differential. The compensating differential is the ability to work for very low wage. Now you might say, well, you know, big deal. But better to work for a low wage than no wage. Because, you know, more is better than zero. And also you learn when you're on the job training. And if you're unemployed by the minimum wage law, if you can't jump over the barrier, and you're consigned to a life of boredom, you get into crime, and the cops have got more guns than these kids, and they go to jail. It's a horrible situation for the economic actors that are weak. And what the minimum wage law does is take away the compensating differential. So it's a very cruel and vicious kind of a thing. It's sort of like taking the quills away from the porcupine or taking the fleetness of foot away from the deer. Okay, what else do I have on minimum wage? Ah, if the minimum wage law is so bad, why do we have it? I mean, I just got through saying that it's just, you know, one of the worst things imaginable in economics, and yet we have it. Well, one reason is ignorance. People just don't know. There was a plebiscite in New Orleans where I live, and the minimum wage law was supposed to rise from $5 an hour to $6 an hour. And two-thirds of the voters voted for it. Most of them are just ignorant. They haven't heard this stuff. Some, I think, are stupid. They've heard it, but they can't understand it. And others are evil and vicious. They know full well what it is, but they still favor it. And who are the people like this? Mainly unions. Because the situation with the union is, here's a union worker who's making, oh, $18 an hour and wants to have a raise until $20 an hour. And look at it from the point of view of the employer. Here, all of a sudden, one factor of production is suddenly becoming more expensive. The natural tendency is to switch into alternative competing factors of production, among which is unskilled workers. Because you can make a widget or a pair of shoes or a shirt or something with various combinations of different kind of factors. Like, for example, to get off the point just for a second, take agriculture. There are various ways to make 100 bushels. This thing is called an isoquant. It's not an indifference curve, so I'm okay on the Austrian school here. This is 100 bushels of wheat. And here what you have is land. And here is either labor or fertilizer or something like that. Take labor, land and labor. Now, there are certain countries that do intensive farming. Lots of workers, very little land. I was in Italy once, and they're up these hills, up these slopes, there are like 10 people working per acre. And they do it very meticulously. So Italy has got a lot of labor and a little land. Japan is like that. On the other extreme, the U.S. has got a lot of land and very little labor. So their, crops per acre aren't so high because they got so many acres, but their crops per person are very high. And they go through the land with a tractor at 10 miles an hour. None of this, you know, detailed work with hands or anything like that. So there are various ways to make the 100 bushels. You can be land intensive, labor intensive, fertilizer intensive, this intensive, that intensive, whatever. Or take another case. You make rowboats. And you can make them out of wood or plastic. And all of a sudden the price of wood shoots up. What do? You move to plastic. Well, similarly, in making maybe not 100 bushels of wheat, but making 100 shirts, you can do it. And now I'll illustrate it not with land and labor, but with skilled labor and unskilled labor. And let's say you're here right now. And all of a sudden, you're the employer, and the union says, hey, you know, we want to go from $18 to $20 an hour. Which way are you going to go? You're going to go this way. You're going to say, okay, I'll fire a few of you guys, two or three, and I'll hire 20 unskilled kids. And instead of having the unskilled people sort of carry the tools for the skilled workers, I'll make each skilled worker a foreman and have 10 unskilled workers, and get the same job done. What does the union think of them apples? The union doesn't like them apples too much. Now, in the good old days of unions, what they would do is they'd, you know, the blue-collar types, they take a baseball bat or a knife and start slashing tires and bopping heads. But now we live in more sophisticated times, and what they do is they promulgate a law which prevents the employer from going toward the unskilled. Namely, they price the unskilled out of the labor market, and this law is called the minimum wage law. Isn't that heinous? I mean, it's bad enough that these blankety-blanks, monstrous people, to use Murray's language, do this, but that they get away with this. And everyone thinks that they're pro-poor and pro-underdog, whereas we capitalist pig types are, you know, horrible people because we don't care about the underdog and we hate the poor and all. It's just the most sublimely unjust thing. It's sort of fun to... I don't know, I must have written maybe, 30 articles on the minimum wage, and people say, well, you're sort of repeating yourself. I never repeat myself verbatim, but I keep saying, you know, as long as that law's on the books, I'm going to get them. You know, so I encourage you all to write articles on the minimum wage. You know, just keep writing articles. It's fun to sort of tweak these pompous noses. It's just wonderful. Okay, I think I'm coming to the end of my notes on... A few more examples. Sometimes it's hard to see the effects of the minimum wage law. One of the biggest percentage increases in the minimum wage law went from 40 to 75 cents. Almost a doubling. It was a gigantic doubling. A gigantic raise in the minimum wage. Before, in the old days, under the 40-cent rule, most elevators, you get into an elevator and there's a guy there. He's not a pervert. What is he doing? He's operating the elevator manually. Now, you people, young people, us old codgers in the front, we know from this stuff. But you young pups out there, if you go to a 30s movie, a black and white movie, they had black and white movies in those days, and you'd see these guys operating the elevator. And it wasn't perfect. You know, now the elevator arrives right at the floor. In those days, they sort of had adjusted to get it right there. And sometimes they wouldn't make it, and they'd say, watch your step up or watch your step down. Well, at 40 cents an hour, it paid employers of high-rise buildings, whether residential or commercial, it doesn't matter, to keep these guys on as elevator operators. But then it rose to 75 cents. Did they fire any elevator operators the next day? Not a one. Not one got fired, because if you fire them, then the elevator doesn't work. You get where I'm coming from? But in the next 2 or 3 years, all of a sudden, every elevator in the country, well, not all of a sudden, it took 2 or 3 or 4 years to automate all the elevators because we had the technology. It's just the technology wasn't economical at 40 cents an hour And now what you had is a substitution of much more sophisticated capital and much more sophisticated labor, namely the labor necessary to create these elevators and to fix them when they went bad, substituted for the unskilled workers. But nobody could see. You know, everyone said, well, one had nothing to do with the other because it didn't occur right away. Right? But we sophisticates in economics can now see that even though it took a long time and other things changed, and this is why sometimes econometric equations go wrong, because they don't have the right time lags. It's a very complicated thing. And if you think that they're testing the minimum wage, they're not, from the Austrian point of view. All they're doing is illustrating it. We know what the right answer is, so it's sort of econometric sort of fudging. Because we know what the right answer is, and when you get the wrong coefficient on the minimum wage, you just throw that out as wrong. I'm sorry? Right. Oh, right. Well, Cardin Kruger, it's a whole other story. I don't want to get into that. Okay, now, I have a few other things I want to say on the minimum wage. One thing is that there's a complicated diagram called monopsony. That's not a misspelling of monopoly. And according to the monopsony diagram, here you have a marginal revenue product, and you have some sort of cost curve, and you have a demand curve. And what the thing proves is that if you're in this range between here and here, the minimum wage can actually rise, and you can have more employment, not less. I don't have time to go through this in my classes. It takes me 2 or 3 weeks, and the kids hate me because it's sort of boring to go through why they say this and then what the Austrian reason is against it. But there is a literature on this from the Austrian point of view, so don't think that we're unaware of this. But I don't have time to go into it. I want to go into a simpler diagram, and the simpler diagram is the following. Here is a situation of supply and demand, quantity of labor, wage. And let's say here is 1,000 employees, and they're making, $5 an hour. And what's the total wage bill? What's the amount of wages paid to all the workers in 1 hour? 5,000. Okay? We have a minimum wage. Let's say the minimum wage law goes up to $7 an hour. And let's suppose that at this point, 900 workers are employed. What's the total wage bill now? Well, 7 times 900 is 6,300. Well, wait a second. I just got through saying the minimum wage law is a bad idea. This doesn't look so bad. Because if the workers get together and cooperate, it's true, 100 of them are unemployed, but you got 6,300 instead of 5,000 that the old 1,000 had, and they could sort of divvy it out, share it, right? I mean, everyone could make $6.30 an hour. On average, not 7, because you have to share it around. Seems pretty good. Seems like a refutation of what I've said. The mistake is in the time lags. It's sort of like the elevator operator. If I did this with elevator operators, what would happen, what I'd be showing you, is here are a bunch of elevator operators. Here is the demand curve for their labor. Here is 40 cents an hour. Here is 70 cents an hour. Let's say there are 100 of them. Well, here they're making 400. Here they're making 1,000, I guess. 700. Doesn't that look great? The answer in the elevator situation is that this demand curve doesn't stay put. This is a very short-run demand curve. What happens, the demand for labor here, is that as time goes on, the demand curve goes like this. And eventually, the demand curve for automatic elevators disappears. Well, it's the same here. Eventually, this curve goes like this. Look, when a major league baseball pitcher pitches, they pitch at 95 miles an hour, 100 miles an hour, something like that. Why do they do it? The reason they do it is because the batter doesn't have a chance to adjust. Whereas when they pitch batting practice, they throw it at 40 miles an hour to give the batters confidence, and then they bat it out of the field, right? Because you have more time to adjust. Well, the more time you have, the more you can adjust. The more time you have, the more you can substitute out of suddenly more expensive factors of production and into cheaper ones. Yes? Okay. Let me give you another example. Us old codgers, when we used to go to a filling station, we'd be attacked by a gang of people. There'd be one guy who would put the gas in, another guy who'd check the oil, another guy would check the tire pressure, another guy would do the front windows, another guy would do the rear windows. Right? Nowadays, you have self-serves because of the minimum wage. In the old days, you would have a waiter or a waitress. They're supposed to be wait persons now. I never caught on to that. I always think of them as waiters and waitresses. Now we have self-serves, cafeterias, even checkout counters in supermarkets are starting with this self-checkout stuff. Minimum wage, minimum wage. It took a few years. It might have taken a few decades. But the market grinds on. When you have minimum wage, it eliminates low-paying jobs, and these people don't have a chance to learn. Okay, I think I'm now finished with the minimum wage. I have a few more things, but I want to get on to unions. So let me get on to unions. According to our friends on the left, the idea is thank God for the union. Because if it weren't for the union, you know, our wages would be, you know, 2 cents an hour, that whole thing. But it's easy to see that this is not true. First of all, if you were to plot wages over the centuries, not over the last couple of years, what you would see is that wages in terms of what a wage can buy or real wages, if you start in the 1500s, and here are wages, and here is time, and here is the year 2000, and here is 1900, 18, 17, 16. Wages were rising. Right? Wages were getting better. Technology was getting better. When did unions start? Well, if you start unions with the IWW, you get to the 1870s. But they really weren't unions. They were sort of hooligans. But you know, they're all hooligans, so I shouldn't say that. But if you really get into union territory, it's the CIO and the AFL, which later amalgamated into the AFL-CIO. When did they come in? 1910, 1920? Something like that. But wages were rising long before their advent, so they could hardly be responsible for wage increases. Another evidence against the unions being responsible for all that is good and true is that in the 1950s, unions, again, here we have time, now we have percentage of the labor force that is unionized. Got it? Percentage of the labor force that's unionized. The figures in 1950 were the highest. There was about 35%, something like that. Don't hold me to the exact number. Now, does anyone know what the percentage of the private labor force that's unionized is? It's about 8 or 9%, it's in single digits. So if you get to 2004, instead of 35, it's 8%. I mean, the whole idea of public sector unions is weird because the whole idea of unions was that the private employer would be greedy, but the government is supposed to be beneficent. So why do you need a public sector union? Nowadays, all we have is public sector unions, practically. The private sector union is very small. Another bit of evidence for this is the Rust Bowl. Rust Bowl, that's what they call it, isn't it? Not Rust Bowl.
Rust Belt.
Rust Belt. Sorry, the Rust Belt. Rust Bowl. I'm losing my marbles here. I'll start drooling in a minute. The Rust Belt. I used to work in this place called Holy Cross in Worcester, Mass. Worcester, Mass. Had a whole bunch of factories producing metal fabricating things. They would produce ball bearings and knives and things like that. You drive around town, you see acres and acres of buildings, factories, 4, 6, 8 stories high, empty. All the jobs went south because of the unions. They're trying to yuppify some of them now, but it's like 1 or 2% of the area that's available is yuppifiable. The rest of it is just sort of sitting there. It's a very eloquent testimony to the economic abomination of unions. Another one is that computers are not unionized. My son works for Microsoft. He's making as much now as I was making a couple of years ago, and he's only 26. It's amazing, the salaries that they've got. Bill Gates is not paying my son because he's unionized. He's paying him because his marginal revenue productivity is high, presumably. So there are many industries where there are no unions and wages are very high. There are countries where they don't have unions. Yes, in Japan they do have unions, but the function of the Japanese union is to lead the workers in the company song. It's a, you know, go, go, IBM or something. I don't know what the, how the song would be, but it's not really the sort of union that we're used to. And then there are non-union states. The union states are losing jobs, the Rust Belt, to the Alabamas and Mississippis and other places like that. Can unions raise wages? Yes, sometimes they can. Do bank robbers raise money? Yes, sometimes they can. But when unions raise wages in one area, they lower them in some other areas. So not only are they stealing from the employer, they're stealing from the other workers. They're brothers or what have you, they're brother workers. Are unions illegitimate in a libertarian society? To get off the Austrian to the Austro-libertarian, no. It all depends on what they do. If what they do is limit themselves to a threat, see, threats are not per se bad. It's the question is, what do you threaten? If I threaten that unless you give me $1 million, I won't be your friend, have I committed violence against you? No, it's a threat, but I'm not threatening violence. If I threaten that unless you give me $1 million, I'm going to punch you in the snout, then yes. So it depends what the threat is. If what the union threat is that if you don't give me money, we're all going to walk out en masse, well, that's not a violent threat. They can walk out. They're free. And what do we call people who are not free to walk out?
Slaves.
They're called slaves. The only problem with slavery was the coerciveness of it. Look, suppose we had the system, this wonderful system, you could pick cotton, you sing songs, and they give you fodder. And, it's great. They bring you down, you're a slave, and you're happy, you know, the happy-go-lucky slave. And then all of a sudden the master comes out with a whip because you're not picking cotton quickly enough, and he whips you and says, oh, okay, I quit. And then he says, you don't understand. You can't quit. So the evil is not so much the slavery, the cotton, and, you know, living in those shacks. The evil is you couldn't quit. The evil was that it was coercion. That's the essence of the evil. Well, if you can't quit, and initially they applied antitrust laws to unions. Namely, they couldn't quit. Well, that was, in effect, enslaving the workforce. So if the only threat is to quit en masse, and you have a little bit more leverage if one guy comes to the boss and says, hey, I don't like your conditions, your working conditions, your money wage, I'm quitting. He says, okay, I got 50,000 other workers, goodbye. But if somebody comes and says, oh, I represent all the workers, and we're all going to quit unless you give us more money, then he has to sort of think, well, you know, it's kind of hard to be replacing 50,000 workers. Not that they'll pick at his place or anything, because that would be coercion. But if they just want to walk out, it's legitimate. So are there any legitimate unions? Well, I once did some research, and I found when I was in Canada, there's this thing called CLAC, Christian Labor Association of Canada. And, you know, I called them up and I said, well, you know, do you use violence? Oh, no, we're Christians, turn the other cheek, this, that, and the other. So I then gave them the part two of the questionnaire. Well, do you support union legislation which forces the employer to bargain you with you whether he likes it or not? And I said, oh, yeah, we support labor legislation. So I had to cross them off my list. You see, the old-fashioned ones before the Wagner Act and all those labor legislation, the employer could say, bye-bye, you don't like it, take a hike. Now, if he says that, he's guilty of an unfair labor practice. He can go to jail. So the employer is, in effect, enslaved. Okay, let me get off unions and talk a little bit about international trade. You know, this latest thing that's in the papers about the offshoring? Offshoring, outsourcing. I'm bad. It's pathetic. I used to be pretty good at this, but I'm losing something. The question you have to ask these people who oppose that is, what's going to happen with the money that we spend there? You know, those dollars that we now spend on Indian workers or Filipino workers, what are they going to do with the money? They can't use it there. It's got to come back here. If it doesn't, then in effect they're making us a free gift of their labor. Sort of like reparations for, you know, just free labor. I mean, people want reparations. You know, so there's some sort of disconnect there. What I want to do is illustrate a comparative advantage and absolute advantage. First, start with absolute advantage. What I'm assuming now is that we have two countries. Canada and Costa Rica. We have 2 days or 2 seasons. We have 2 products, bananas and maple syrup. And we're thinking of what the situation is before trade. So first we'll have the no trade situation. Okay. What does the, and I'm assuming that these 2 products consist of the entire GDP. So what does the Canadian GDP look like? Well, Canada can produce 10,000 units of maple syrup and 5 bananas. How do you produce bananas in Canada? It's a cool place.
Greenhouses.
Will you stop ruining my example? Quiet. Greenhouses is the way to go. Those Okanagan banana places are probably government subsidized. I don't really know the Okanagan banana situation, but I do know that in Newfoundland, they were subsidizing cucumbers in greenhouses. It was, you know, $25 for a cucumber. It was really wild. Okay, so you produce greenhouse bananas. So you have a GDP of 10,005 because I'm assuming additive. How do they do bananas in Costa Rica? 15,000. How do they do maple syrup in Costa Rica? Gigantic refrigerators? It costs a bit, but look, you know, we have to preserve the Costa Rican maple syrup industry. You Costa Rican people who don't support the maple syrup industry are not Costa Rican patriots. You're giving in to the enemy of outsourcing or outmaneuvering something with maple syrup. So you people should be ashamed of yourself laughing at gigantic refrigerators. You know? Okay, so now we have a GDP of 15,020 and 10,005. And how many bananas do we have in the whole world? The world consists of these 2 countries. Well, now we add vertically, so we get 15,005. Everyone following the thing? And how many maple syrup units do we have? We have 10,020. And what is world GDP? 25,025. Okay, now what we do is we open it up to trade. And if we're going to trade, which rationally will each country specialize in? They'll specialize in what they have an absolute advantage in. Absolute advantage means I'm better at this than you, and absolute advantage the other way is you're better at the other than me. So we each specialize. And now, Canada spends 2 growing seasons or 2 days just on maple syrup. It produces no bananas whatsoever. But since it can produce 10,000 in 1 growing season, and it now has 2 growing seasons, it can produce 20,000 of maple syrup units. Costa Rica can produce 30,000 because it can do 15,000 each time, and now it doubles it, so you get 30. What is world GDP? 50. So world GDP just about doubled. Now, to be fair to our friends who are the protectionists, I have to admit that most of them would not want to have tariff protections against tropical fruits, with the exception of Hawaii. That, you know, some snotty kid will bring up Hawaii. Quiet. We don't want to hear about Hawaii. Most countries will not want to have a problem with this. Most say, okay, we'll have an exception for this, because the local people are not very powerful in the Canadian banana industry, and the Costa Rican maple syrup industry is not that. Although, you know, if there were Keynesians there, they'd start saying, well, think of the poor banana producers in Canada. The ones in the hothouses, they'll lose their jobs, they'll stop spending, and, you know, the other people will stop spending. And then there's this crap about, I mean, I shouldn't say crap, I'm being professorial. And then there are these fallacies about retraining retraining the Canadian banana workers. You know, lo, the poor Canadian banana workers. They're out of a job. They have to adjust and get in the maple syrup industry, and you have to give them, you know, 5 years of salary to go to maple syrup school or something like that. The point is that the people who really take a hit are not the people with non-specialized training. If all you're doing is at a minimum wage level and you're sweeping a banana floor, you can sweep a maple syrup floor. You don't really lose much. The people who do lose a lot are the hothouse people in Canada, the technicians, because they have no job now, and the people that have capital there. So they're hiding behind, it's the higher workers, the more skilled workers, and the capitalist pig types, and now I mean it seriously, they're the ones that are behind this because the big subsidies come to them. Okay, now let me quickly go over comparative advantage. In comparative advantage, it's a little more complicated. I again assume two countries, two seasons, two whatevers, Canada and Japan. And I assume that Japan is better than Canada in both things. Now, this is the case that really gets the protectionists going. I assume that the Japanese are 33 times better at TV sets and only twice as good at wheat. So you can see the numbers. Without trade, the world GDP is 2008. Everyone sees the numbers. I'm not going to go over them because I'm just about out of time. Canada has 38, Japan has 170, there are 105 wheat units, there are 103 TV units, world GDP is 208. Now we introduce trade, and each country specializes in what it does best comparatively. Now here's the key. Japan is only twice as good as Canada in wheat. They're not really that good. Or Canada's fully half as good as Japan in wheat. Whereas in TVs, Japan really kicks butt. Right? And Canada is pathetic. So they each specialize in their comparative advantage. And Canada has 70 wheats. Japan has 200 TV sets. And now we go from 208 to 270. Another example, a numerical example that I use to illustrate this, is a lawyer and a typist. The lawyer can make 1,000 a day. See, the point is, would it pay Japan to deal with the likes of Canada, pathetic Canada? And the answer is yes. Similarly, would it pay for the lawyer to deal with the typist? And the answer is yes. If the lawyer works one day as a lawyer and then one day as a typist, he makes $11.50. But if he works 2 days as a lawyer and he pays the typist $300 for 2 days of typing, he makes $1,700. So there are lots of examples that show that comparative advantage does work, and I'm out of time. Thanks for your attention.